The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And tonight, the topic that I thought to explore is the topic of perception. And maybe that sounds like a technical topic, or why is that useful or helpful? But perception is one of the ways in which we meet the world. The Buddha talked about different processes of body and mind that are kind of our interface to our experience in the world. And perception is one of those processes. So I wanted to explore, first of all, what it is, how it works, and a little bit of how we might be able to recognize it, see it in our experience. And then also explore why it's useful to see this as a process of mind. Actually, just to give you a little bit of maybe a taste or a little kind of forward pointer, not recognizing that perception is a functioning of mind, and not recognizing that largely we are meeting the world through our perceptual processes, we interpret and can even attribute things to the world that are simply constructs of our own mind. And we can also then get stuck, caught, and struggle around that. So it's actually a pretty important aspect of our experience to begin to at least learn something about, and learn something about how it works. So this process of perception is it's a process of how we recognize what's happening in the world. It's related to memory. And so, you know, we when we're children, you know, when we're babies, as we look around the world, we don't know the names of things. You know, we actually are kind of seeing things in a more, you know, I think we're seeing forms in color, but we're not really identifying objects in the same way that we identify them now. And so as we learn and as we grow and meet the world and see things over and over again, we see similar things and we begin to develop these categories. Our mind is really good at creating different categories. So, you know, looking out here, I'm seeing chairs, lots of chairs, and they're pretty similar. There's a few that are different, but, you know, I definitely, you know, if you walking here for the first time tonight, it's not going to confuse you about what these are. You know, you've seen enough chairs to recognize, oh, that's a chair. I know what chairs are. I know how to use them, even though you may never have seen that particular chair before. And so this is part of how perception works. It helps us to navigate the world. It helps us to recognize what's going on. So, you know, the looking out, seeing chairs and walls and windows and people, this is perception helping me to know this. And perception, one of the functions of perception is to help us kind of name or label or recognize kind of just the objects of the world. There's some other aspects of perception, too. It's not just the naming, although that's probably the most obvious, the easiest one to begin to see and recognize. But it also helps us, perception helps us with space, with time, with distance. And so at one point I was meditating, I was in Hawaii and I was doing a retreat in a little cabin in a property in Hawaii, and there wasn't a lot of human sounds, but there were a lot of bird sounds. And I began noticing how the mind, when I heard, because it was like birds all around me, like this 360 degree space created by the sound of the birds. And it almost felt like the mind kind of leapt out in space when a bird sounded. It's like, oh yeah, that one's over there, and that one's over there. And I was in a room that just had a window next to it. And so, you know, it's like the mind was creating this 360-degree space, even though the sound was probably just coming in this side window. And so this is perception. Perception helps us to recognize these things. So it's a pretty powerful function of our mind, and it's an extremely useful one. You know, we want to be able to recognize what's going on around us. We want to know that that's a door and that's a wall, and I can walk through the door, but I can't walk through a wall. You know, we don't want to stop perception. It helps us to navigate living. This perceptual process is I think of it, and I've seen it in kind of subtler states of meditation, seeing how it's a kind of a layered process, because there's many different levels at which we can perceive things. So we can perceive things as chairs, but we also know something about their shape, and we know something about their color. And so that's another level of perception, is like the kind of, it's a little more fundamental. The form, the color will be perceived. And so, you know, this thing, bowl-shaped and brown, will be perceived first, those things. And, you know, if you just walk in here the very first time, you might think, what's a bowl doing up there? And then you realize that it's a bell. So, you know, that our perceptual processes work first at the level of shape, of form and color in our visual field. In our auditory, it works at pitch and tone. So, you know, this sound, we hear the pitch and tone of it, the wavering quality of it. All of that is perceived. But then the mind also kind of congeals around an idea of bell. So we have the level of, you know, the subtler level, or the foundational level of experience, and then the object level of experience. And it can even get more specific, you know. So when we're especially around people, like first we might recognize that's a person as opposed to an animal. And then we might recognize the gender of the person. Then we might recognize that it is a specific person. And so again, different levels of recognition that happen. In terms of, you know, we can see this. We can hear it and understand that this happens. You know, we can kind of nod our heads and go, yep, that does happen. But there's a way in which we can actually see in our meditative process that this is something happening in our minds. We don't often think about it. Like, we walk into a room and we don't necessarily see the perceptual process at work. We're just seeing chairs and walls and windows. And so we're just perceiving things. We're not seeing that perception is happening. And so this is, again, it may sound like a kind of a, why do I need to see that perception is happening? But hopefully by the end of this talk, you'll have a sense of why it's useful. But just to speak a few minutes about what you might, how you might be able to see this, what could happen here. So when you're sitting in meditation, and in my own experience, the field of hearing is probably the easiest place to start to recognize that that perception is happening. Especially when we're sitting with our eyes closed, we are, you know, sitting and just feeling our experience, knowing what's happening, experiencing our body sensations, and then suddenly we hear a sound. You know, there's often we will hear, here at night, we'll hear cars go by, or motorcycles, or we'll hear a car alarm go off. And so, you know, you'll hear these sounds, and there's the sound itself, with the sound hitting the eardrum, the sound waves hitting the eardrum, and the mind kind of maybe recognizing something about the pitch and tone. But very quickly, the mind will recognize that's a car, or that's a car alarm, or that's a motorcycle. And the way that it does that is often through a very rudimentary form of thought. And so you will perhaps, as you're sitting there, hear the mind or notice that when there's the sound of a car going by, your mind will say something like, oh, that's a car, or car alarm, or something like that. You might recognize that the mind actually identifies the experience. Now, it may be that the perceptual process is a pretty subtle process, and so sometimes what we're actually recognizing is a step or two after the perception has happened, and we're starting to actually think about what we've heard. And so, oh, that's a car, or that's a motorcycle. I know motorcycles. That's that kind of motorcycle. So we've actually shifted from the recognition of the experience to thinking a little bit about what we are experiencing. But there are times when we can actually recognize that first kind of identification of some experience. Sometimes this will happen through as if the mind were saying the word of the experience: car, bird, alarm, person, door, those kinds of things. We may hear the mind say those things. Or it also, another way that I've seen, as my mind gets a little more settled, I will often see an image in the mind that is like a representation of what I have heard. So I might see an image of a car, or have an image, if I'm hearing like the door open out there, I might see an image of somebody walking in the door, or hearing footsteps, see somebody walking across the room. So that kind of visual can also be the perceptual process at work. So it can come in through different ways, this recognition of experience. But we can begin to see that. So we can start to recognize that our perceptions are happening in our mind. And this is actually pretty important, because what we respond to in our relationship to the world, this is, so what we respond to isn't what's actually out there. So, you know, there's the car going by, and we have an image of a car, we think about the car, or, you know, the car alarm, you know, there's the car alarm that goes off, and we're responding not to simply the sound, but to our perception, our recognition of that sound. And so what we are meeting, this is one of the really kind of mind-blowing aspects of seeing what's going on in our minds, that what we relate to when we meet the world isn't what's actually out there. It's what we are perceiving internally. So an example of this, it's easier to know that this is what goes on when our perception makes a mistake. When we think we're perceiving something, but it's not actually there. And our perception can easily make mistakes. The kind of classic in the Buddhist texts, there's a classic example of this, of walking into a darkened room or a darkened barn or something, and seeing a coiled form in the corner and thinking it's a snake. And then what happens? You know, you see that's how it's perceived. You know, you see the thing, that's how it's perceived, and the mind responds to that experience based on the perception. So we think it's a snake. So what happens? We get a little frightened, our emotions get charged, our body kind of gears up, and then maybe somebody comes in and turns on the light and we see it's a rope rather than a snake. And so we can see or we can begin to, through that little thought experiment, recognize that when we respond to the world, we're not actually responding to what's out there. We're responding to what we are perceiving. Now, our perceptual processes, I think, do a really good job. And so that's part of the of what happens for us, is that we begin to trust or believe that what we're perceiving is actually what's out there, and that what we are meeting is what's going on out there, rather than what we are experiencing is what's created in our minds. So that's a place where confusion can enter, where delusion can enter, that we actually go around believing that what we are experiencing is accurate. I had an experience on one long meditation retreat in Burma. I was there for 7 weeks or so at one point, and I had a room in a building that was pretty close to the edge of the monastery wall. And, Burma is kind of notorious for having a lot of sounds. It's kind of a noisy place. And the village was nearby, and there were loudspeakers and lots of noise coming into the monastery over the walls. And one evening I was meditating in my room, and I began to hear this very odd squealing sound. It was late in the afternoon, and that to me, the perception that I experienced. So I noticed that it was squealing. So there was that squealing sound, and the mind perceived that sound as pig, and so I thought this was a pig squealing on the other side of the monastery wall, and my mind. Thought, you know, so this part I began to see was added, you know, I could see that the mind was thinking a little bit and laying ideas on top of the sound and the perception. But it sounded to me like that squeal was distressed. And so I thought, And actually what I began noticing, this happened over several days. I think the first few days it was just like, oh, there's that pig squealing. And then the next day, oh, pig squealing again. Oh, pig squealing again. So each day around the same time, there was this squealing that happened. And over those days, I began to feel like that this was a distressed squeal. And so my mind created the idea that this was the butcher. And the pigs were being slaughtered each day at this time. And so there was a response to that. There was a feeling of sadness and compassion and a whole bunch of things going on there. Now, I did know that I didn't actually know if there was a slaughterhouse on the other side of that monastery wall. But still, that was being recognized. So there was the squealing, the recognition of it as pig, and then there was some extra stuff that happened after that. And then one evening, or one late afternoon, I decided to take a walk about that time rather than to be in my room. And while I was walking, I started noticing that there were these things flying around, and they kind of flew really close, and they'd go, whoosh, whoosh. They were bats, and they were squealing. And in that moment, it was like, wow, you know, I saw in that moment that I had seen that the whole idea about slaughterhouse and pigs being slaughtered was, you know, my mind making something up. But it wasn't until that moment that I had really seen how much my mind had believed in the pigness. You know, that it was a pig that was squealing. There were no pigs. There was no slaughtering. There was, you know, there's no need for compassion. You know, it's just this, the mind had perceived something. I mean, up until that point, I hadn't experienced squealing bats. So I didn't have anything to perceive that as bat. Now, the next time, you know, going to Burma now, I know there are other things that squeal than pigs. So our minds learn over time about what we what we're experiencing and can correct for perceptions. But the key piece or the key kind of area to kind of take note of here is how much our minds will believe that what we are perceiving is what's actually out there. So that's kind of one piece of how the mind can get confused. We can think we are experiencing what's actually out there, but what we are experiencing is our perception of what's out there. Our perception plus the, you know, the feeling that goes with it, the body sensation that goes with it. So given that, what we are perceiving is created by our mind, another important or big avenue where we can get confused, or where you know, the beginning of suffering can come in, is that we have a lot of ideas and beliefs and views about the world. I mean, we may not have that many beliefs and views about chairs or walls or windows. I mean, maybe we do. Maybe we walk in here and think, well, those are really, you know, functional chairs, but they're, you know, kind of boring. Or so, you know, we have some views that when we perceive something, it's like when the perception happens, if we're not really aware of what's going on, our mind will like pick up a whole bunch of conditioning that is associated with perceptions that we've had that are similar to those in the past. And so those views, beliefs, ideas can come in and then influence our relationship to those experiences without our really being aware of it. Because so much of this happens kind of below the surface of our conscious awareness. So another kind of example about this might be you know, you meet somebody for the first time. And often when we meet somebody for the first time, we have a kind of a gut feeling, you know, a gut feeling about them. We like them or we don't like them. There's something we like or we don't like. And my sense is that a lot of that gut feeling actually comes from some kind of history of perception. There's something about that person, maybe a body shape or a kind of a particular style that they have that reminds us of somebody. And maybe that person that they remind us of, there's some emotional kind of baggage connected to that. And so, like, without even being aware of it, in meeting this person for the first time, we are bringing that with us. So we've perceived them as a person, and we've perceived the style and the, you know, the body shape. And because our mind has all these associative links, it's like through those associations, some of these beliefs and views or even emotional resonances can come along for the ride. And if we are not aware that our mind is creating our experience and our relationship to experience, we may believe the views and emotions are accurate. Now, it's not that we need to dismiss all of that, but it's really useful to recognize those as kind of history or conditioning coming in, so that we can weigh, is this actually a useful perspective to bring here? Or is it actually, you know, not at all relevant? So this process of perception can get us into trouble when we don't understand it as perception. The Buddha used an analogy for perception. And he said, perception is like a mirage. I looked up mirages and how they work. And the most classic mirage, the oasis in the desert. When I looked this up in Wikipedia, they had some amazing photos of mirages of water in the desert. And it's kind of like, when I first saw that, it's like, wow, you can even take a picture of a mirage. You know, it's not a just purely a mental thing. It's actually something that's physical. You know, it's an optical kind of illusion. And what a mirage is, my understanding in terms of reading the description, that particular mirage of the water in the desert, is that the heat waves coming off the desert create kind of almost like a mirror. The heat waves there create something that essentially the sky will reflect in. And so you see the reflection of the sky on the ground, and because the sky is blue, it looks like water on the ground. The pictures on Wikipedia even show like the mountains in the distance being reflected in that water. I mean, it's like it's such a convincing illusion that there's water there. But one of the things I love about this analogy is that what is being reflected there, it's a reflection. You know, there's something. It's not just a complete illusion. It's reflecting something that exists, but it's reflecting it in a way that it's being interpreted as something that it's not. And so the sky exists, but it's a reflection. So a mirage is actually a reflection. It's a reflection that something that's there, a reflection of something that's there. And so very similarly, our perceptions, they're not the thing that's out there, but they're like reflections. So we are, it's like in our mind is this amazing reflection of the world. And that's how we are navigating the world, is through this reflection. And because it's so convincing, we can easily take it to be what it's not, easily take it to be what's actually out there. There's a story in the time of the Buddha of another way that this this process of perception can get us into trouble. And it's related to this taking what we have perceived to be the reality, to be what's there. And this is the story of the blind people and the elephant. Many of you may have heard this story. I had certainly heard it before I ever heard about Buddhism, but it's actually a teaching story that the Buddha used in his teaching. And he describes, you know, the story of a king who asks his elephant trainer to bring an elephant and somebody to bring the blind people in the kingdom to see the elephant. And the blind people, some of the blind people are told to touch particular parts of the elephant and told, this is the elephant. I'll read a little bit of this. To some of the blind people, they presented the head of the elephant, saying, this is an elephant. To some presented the ear of the elephant, saying, this is an elephant. To some the tusk, to some the trunk, the body, the foot, the hindquarters, the tail, the tuft at the end of the tail, saying, this is an elephant. Then the king approached them and said, have you been shown the elephant? Tell me, what was the elephant like? Those who'd been shown the ears replied, an elephant is like a winnowing basket. Those the body, an elephant is like a storeroom. Those the foot or the leg, an elephant is like a post. Those the tuft at the end of the tail, an elephant is like a broom. And saying, an elephant is like this, an elephant is not like that. They fought each other with their fists. So that was what the Buddha was pointing to in terms of the kind of another one of the dangers around perception. In believing our perceptions to be the reality, we exclude other possible interpretations and understandings. There's a famous quote, one of my favorite little snippets of the Buddhist teachings. Those attached to perceptions and views roam the world offending people. And we see this in our world now, how much perception and views create suffering, creates strife, creates war. So this story of the blind people and the elephant points to two pieces, or more than two, actually, I think. So there's the perception that happens. Well, there's the perception plus, I think, the piece of, they were being somewhat, I would say, they were being misguided when the person said, this is an elephant, instead of saying, this is a part of an elephant, right? I mean, that would have made a big difference if that's how they had been shown the elephant. But they were told, this is an elephant. And so, you know, it's pointing to how our mind can reify something. Take something that we see, oh, this is an elephant, or this is X, and then we take that to be X without looking to see, is there a bigger picture? Is there more to the picture? So it's not at all wrong to say that this part of the elephant, the leg of the elephant, is like a post. That's a pretty good analogy. But it's not the whole picture. And so what the Buddha's pointing to here is when we come up with these kind of reified ideas and hold to them. So we have the perception, we create the view, this is what it is, and we tend to cling to our views, we tend to cling to that, and then if other people present alternative views, we're not open, we're often not so open to those alternatives. And so this is a big warning that the Buddha offered us around perception. That when we cling to perceptions, we tend to create the idea that this is what is happening. You know, that's what is here. That's what is true. And we tend to then not see other possible scenarios, other possible situations. And we actually do this a lot, this kind of thing. blocking out possibilities. You know, we have perceptions. I mean, we have so that this is kind of a shift from a perception to a view around the perception, kind of a concept and an idea and a view. And this is where our mind kind of gets solid or stuck around things. When we recognize that perception is perception, there's a lot more fluidity to the mind, a lot more recognition or fluidity of, oh, this is what I'm perceiving right now. And we may see that along with that comes some ideas or views, but we can, well, this is what's being perceived, and these are the ideas that are coming with that. Okay, can I hold that lightly? So one way, just an example from my practice around how this showed up at one point. I was sitting waiting for a meeting with my teacher on a retreat, and this was a silent retreat, and met my teacher about every third day, so hadn't talked for 3 days, and in that situation often I was a little bit anxious. Had a little bit of agitation going on. And I was sitting there waiting for my teacher, and I was feeling energy in my body, and my perception of that energy was, this is anxiety. And so I was just noticing that anxiety was happening. And so that was the perception of that energy, that the mind was anxious. And then as I kept sitting there and watching the experience, the interview before me went on, the meeting that the teacher was having before me went on for a while, and so I got to watch this for quite a while, maybe about 10 minutes or so. I got to observe this energy in the body and feel the sensations, and I was still kind of noticing it or naming it as anxiety. But then as the time went on, I began to get curious, because it wasn't changing, you know. It wasn't there. It was just like, it's like, well, huh, this is interesting. It's neither getting stronger or weaker. It's just, you know, it's just kind of staying the same. And I got a little more curious about the actual physical sensations. Stopped kind of labeling it anxiety and began feeling the vibration and the kind of movement of the energy, which was kind of a quivering kind of energy that was moving from the feet up the body, and kind of feeling a little bit almost excited or something. And as I felt that, I began to realize, oh, this is actually a kind of a joy and a delight. This isn't anxiety. The context that I was in of sitting there waiting for my teacher had kind of informed how I perceived that experience. And so, you know, that kind of thing happens to us a lot, that we take in experience and we perceive it in a certain way because of context, because of situation, because of history, and we're not actually looking at what's really going on. So the last piece I want to just point to before I open it up for kind of conversation and questions is this beginning to recognize perception as a process, you know, and recognizing that how we are relating to the world is mediated through this reflection of perception. That we can't actually know what's happening out there. It does a pretty good job, but there's a lot of room for mistaken perceptions. So that's the first level of problem that can happen there. But then more fundamentally or more, dangerously, is that we can believe that what we are perceiving and our views and our opinions about that are true. And that is that's a big place where we end up in this, no, you're wrong, I'm right, where we cannot have conversations about different opinions. And so this seeing, we can begin to see that everything we are experiencing, and we can begin to know that everything we are experiencing is mediated by our mind. And because of that, it's very prone to influence from our conditioning, from our views and our beliefs. How we perceive things, that example of the anxiety and the delight, you know, how we perceive things is conditioned based on our history. How we respond to things is conditioned. How we respond to our perceptions is conditioned based on our history. And so the whole of our experience being mind, or what we can experience, is created by our minds. There's a very easy kind of slip that we can make into believing that what we are experiencing is reality, and interpreting it in that way. Another example of the danger of that is like eyewitness, single eyewitness conviction for murder. You know, the understanding how perception works. I would not feel like I could convict somebody based on single eyewitness testimony, even based on a reliable witness, what's called a reliable witness, because it is so easy for perception to influence, for views and ideas and beliefs to influence what we're perceiving. So everything we're experiencing is made by our minds. And that is humbling, I think, for us to begin to recognize that. So as we begin to see this and begin to recognize that how we're relating to the world is not directly, but it's indirect. It's an indirect relationship to the world. We can also start to see that the ways in which we suffer, the ways in which we struggle, the ways in which we have difficulty in the world are deeply connected to this. So, you know, the struggle that we have in the world, what we call struggle, what we call suffering, is primarily has to do with our relationship to what's out there in the world, not to what's actually out there in the world. Now, there are definitely things that happen in the world that create pain in our experience. People engage unethically. People harm people. And so there is this kind of part of our reality that somebody can harm us. And so I'm not saying that that's like, you know, constructed by your mind, that somebody is harming you. What we are experiencing of that, all that we can experience of that, is our mind's experience of it. And the suffering that we have, so this is a little bit of a stretch at first for us to understand this. The ways in which we suffer, you know, if somebody is doing something to us, or we are experiencing something that's unpleasant, the vast majority of our suffering around that is not the unpleasantness itself. There is unpleasantness that happens in the world. However, we don't have to suffer with that unpleasantness. so much of what we call suffering is not in the actual objective pleasantness, unpleasantness, relationship. It's in the relationship to that. We like certain things. We want them. We want to hold on to them. We don't like other things. We want to get rid of them. If we can, as we begin to explore this aspect of our, this is also a part of our minds, this relationship to experience, our mind is doing this. And that's also constructed, that's also conditioned by history. Our the way in which we meet something pleasant, the way in which we meet something unpleasant, our particular relationships to experience is conditioned. And so the wanting and the not wanting, the greed and the aversion around experience is also constructed by our minds. And as we begin to be curious about the greed and aversion, we start to see that so much of how our minds feel distress is primarily in that terrain of the greed and aversion and the confusion that comes with it. This is something that for me, it did not make any sense until I began really looking at my experience and began exploring. And, it's like just as a simple example, exploring a pain in my body, a physical pain in my body, a physically strongly unpleasant experience in my body, and noticing the aversion to it and seeing how when the aversion is strong, the entire experience was very, very painful. There's a lot of suffering around that when the aversion was strong. And it's like, as the aversion got strong, it's like the pain turned up like many, many notches more pain as the aversion was strong. But then as in watching this pattern, seeing the aversion get strong, sometimes it gets a little weaker, sometimes it gets strong, weak. Seeing, it's almost like seeing somebody changing a dial on the pain. As the aversion gets strong, it's like, whoo, it gets really much stronger. As it gets weaker, the pain gets weaker. And then at one point in that exploration, the aversion just vanished. There was no aversion to the unpleasant experience. And that experience, it was kind of mind-blowing. It was like, that doesn't feel like pain anymore. It feels like an unpleasant experience. And so that was one of the lessons for me around how much of our suffering is in this relationship. And so this relationship to experience, the wanting, the aversion, that's our mind doing that. But then the other piece of this is that what we are relating to, I mean, even that example of the physical pain, you know, what we are relating to is also our mind's reflection of the experience. That's all that we can relate to, is our mind's reflection of the experience. And often the suffering around that isn't so much about the actual experience, like in that case, the actual experience of the kind of coming and going, the pulsing and vibrating sensation of the unpleasant feeling of that physical pain, that physical unpleasant sensation. But the aversion was more in relationship to the idea of that pain and some idea in particular of this is going to go on for another 40 minutes until the sitting ends. And so the idea of the pain or the idea of the sensation was really what the mind was reacting to. And so our perceptions, our concepts, this is a huge place where we are clinging. You know, we don't actually cling. We cannot cling to actual experience. There's nothing to cling to because it's just changing so dynamically. But our minds kind of reify our perceptions, reify our experience, and make something out of it, create a thing to which we think we can cling, create a kind of a thing that travels through space and time. This pain is going to be here for 40 minutes. And then we cling to that. And so what we are clinging to, so we have this relationship of clinging and aversion and greed to our experience. But largely what we are clinging to is not something actual out there, but some idea or concept in our own minds. This is basically how most of our suffering is created. And so when we see that that aversion is there, one thing that can be really useful, or that greed, whatever it is, that when there's some suffering, it can be really useful to be curious, well, what am I actually clinging to? What am I actually averse to? What is it that I really want here? I'll tell one more story. At one point, I was practicing on long retreat, and I had this strong wanting for a particular meditation experience that my teachers had been describing. And, you know, they described this experience, and I had so much wanting to have that experience. It sounded really cool. And I was experiencing a lot of suffering around that wanting, frustration I wasn't experiencing, a lot of trying to find that experience, make myself meditate well enough that I could have that experience. And then one day I was doing some walking meditation, and I was a little struggling with this, and as I was noticing the struggle and the frustration and the wanting around it, I saw my mind kind of create this image of telling my teacher that I had had that experience. And you know, it's like, and we were laughing and appreciating, and it's like, oh, you know, actually what I want is to tell somebody that I've had that experience. That's really what I want, so that somebody thinks a certain way about me. And that was so helpful to see. That's what I was actually clinging to. I wasn't clinging to that, wanting that actual experience, because I had no idea what it was. I'd heard somebody tell a story about it. And so, you know, just beginning to see what it is we're actually clinging to when we are suffering. It's like, oh, what is it that I'm really wanting here? What is it that I really don't like here? And maybe it feels like, yeah, this situation is what I don't like. Okay, well, if that's what you're able to notice, just notice that. But sometimes we can kind of touch in a little more deeply to recognize that what we are either wanting or wanting to get rid of is nothing more than something the mind has made up. So our perceptual processes have actually been kind of co-opted by a form of delusion that has us believing our perceptions to be a reality. And then we cling to that kind of belief in that reality. So, yeah, we've got just a minute or two, if there's really just a minute, if there's any quick comment. And just use the mic here.
One thing that I've noticed recently in the meditation is, I think what you were saying is how our perception is, you know, kind of a reflection of all of our past conditioning. I've been noticing in the meditation lately that my meditation, it's like it's becoming very predictable. It's like I kind of feel like I know what's going to happen in the meditation.
Uh-huh.
It's like the whole experience of meditation is like becoming like a very familiar, like perception. Like a very, yeah. I realize that that's kind of new. Like for most of my experience in meditation, it's like I didn't know it was going to happen. When you first start meditating, it's always new. Like but now it's becoming very familiar. Like I kind of know what my body's going to do. I know what my mind's going to do. There's kind of like a time course to it every time I sit and. I think that there's a really big benefit or wisdom from that, because it's like I'm not always looking for a new experience. Like I'm not trying to get this awesome enlightenment experience every time I sit or something like that. So there's like this kind of like trust of like, you know, I'm sitting and I'm not trying to get a specific kind of experience. But on the other hand, I can also see that it's like leading to like maybe a loss of this beginner's mind.
Like, well, I mean, it could be leading to I mean, it's got more sides than that. But mm-hmm. you know, one thing that I'd point to is, like, yes, it can be very useful to begin to recognize kind of these paths that are, so these grooves that our minds find their way in. It's like with meditation, as with other things, our minds kind of find their way and then, like, get familiar with those ways. And so that can be really useful. It's almost a shortcut in, kind of like perception is a shortcut to recognizing experience. We don't have to work as hard. One of the dangers there, though, is, you know, and so I would just encourage you to just notice that that's happening. The one piece that I'd encourage a kind of a little caution about is, if it happens someday that it doesn't go that way, you know, that it's not like it's going, it's like, you don't have to say, well, what's wrong? It's not doing that. Because that's just one way that the system can settle. And so it's doing that right now, and that's fine. And, you know, even recognizing, oh, this is a pattern. You know, so it's fine to recognize it. And if you're recognizing it as a pattern, I think that's helpful. But then the kind of caution would be to not say, to make that pattern something concrete. To say, oh, this is the way settling happens. Because there's many ways that can happen. So, you know, that's a little bit of the danger there. But I would say, you know, it's not. Just notice that that's happening, and see, you know, just begin to be curious about whether the mind kind of begins to cling to that. It doesn't sound like it is at this point. It actually sounds like it's.
I do think that sometimes, like, my mind, I prefer to inhabit the idea of it than the actual thing.
Well, that's useful to notice.
And so I think that there's a kind of a laziness. Yeah.
Is it actually going that way, or are you kind of hallucinating that it's going that way?
But thank you.
So thank you for your attention this evening.